So tonight's study is on the fellowship offering, the grain offering and the priests, which sounds just like the kind of thing you really wanted to come out for tonight, wasn't it? And we're going to begin by looking at one of the offerings that we haven't looked at yet, the grain offering. And the grain offering has some connections with the fellowship offering, there's some similarity. So I thought we'd do those, throw this one in now as we look at it, as we work our way through the implications of the fellowship offering. So Leviticus chapter 2, I'll just read the first three verses so you get a bit of a feel for the grain offering. When someone brings a grain offering to the Lord, his offering is to be of fine flour. He's to pour oil on it, put incense on it, and take it to Aaron's sons, the priests. The priest shall take a handful of the fine flour and oil, together with all the incense, and burn this as a memorial portion on the altar, an offering made by fire, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. The rest of the grain offering belongs to Aaron and his sons. It's a most holy part of the offerings made to the Lord by fire. Okay, so we've been looking at these offerings for a while now. Similarities with the other offerings? What's similar? Any similarities? You take it to the priest, that's right. So first of all, actually you're bringing it to the Lord, really, aren't you? You're bringing an offering to the Lord. So this is something that you bring to the tabernacle or to the temple, and you present it to him, and then you give it to the priest to deal with. So that's definitely a similarity. A portion goes to the priest. Which other offerings have we seen that happen with?
Burnt.
No, not the burnt offering. Yeah, it's the fellowship offering. Remember that in the fellowship offering, which is an animal, the priest gets the right shoulder and the right breast piece. Yeah.
Fire involved as well.
There's fire. There's things being burned up on the altar.
What does the word fine flour mean?
Fine flour, we'll come to that, yeah. So
that could be another sense of the choice
quality. Yeah, that's right. It is actually about quality. So there's this thing of bringing the best of a thing.
Yeah.
That's been all the way through, hasn't it? What are the differences that you picked up?
It doesn't involve animals.
There's no animals. So there were some, with the sin offering, there was the possibility of offering grain as part of the sin offering, if you remember. If you were very poor, you could offer grain, but that's the only time other than this that we've run into grain offerings.
Any? Oil and incense,
huh? Yeah, oil and incense. There's this kind of oil that's mixed with it in a way, and incense that's placed on top. Yep. Anything else in the words there that you hadn't heard before?
Memorial portion.
Yeah, a memorial portion. That's a really key word with regard to the grain offerings, is that there's a bit that's burned up as a memorial portion. We'll look at that and see what that's all about. And and then the rest of it goes to Aaron and his sons. Remember, with the fellowship offering, a portion went to Aaron and his sons. A portion was burnt up, all the fatty bits were burnt up. A portion went to Aaron and his sons, and the rest was eaten by the offerer. With the grain offering, a portion is burnt up, and then the rest of it goes to Aaron and his sons. It's not just it's not really a celebration meal, the grain offering. It's sort of making a very definite provision for the priests. So we'll look at all those things. So the procedures and regulations for the grain offering in Leviticus are found in this chapter, which is all the instructions for the offerers. And then in chapter 6, verses 14 to 23, where you've got the instructions for the priests. The grain could be offered either as uncooked fine flour, that's what we've just read about. So you could bring uncooked flour mixed with oil and with incense on top, and you could offer that, or you could actually cook up the flour before you came and make a kind of a bread with it. And there were three different ways you could make bread. That's in verses 4 through to 10. You could cook it in an oven, and if it was prepared on a griddle, which I guess, is that like a grill? Or you could, if you did that, you were meant to break it all up into bits, a bit like the communion bread in some churches, you know, the little biscuits get all broken up into bits. That's this would be like, breaking up the bread into chunks. But you could cook it in a pan, which may be a bit more like a fried kind of thing. So there are various ways you could bring bread. So you could either bring it as the ingredients for bread, the oil and the flour, or you could bring it as prepared bread, and that was the grain offering. All of these offerings was to be offered without yeast, but you did have to season it with salt. If you go down to verse 13, it says, season all your grain offerings with salt, that is, put salt in the mix. And do not leave the salt of the covenant of your God out of your grain offerings. So the salt was something to do with the covenant of God. We'll look at that in a moment. Add salt to all your offerings. So he keeps saying it, doesn't it? So it's obviously a very important thing that there's salt in this offering. A third grain offering is then in verses 14 to 16. Haven't put those references there, sorry. And that's the offering of first fruits. You've probably heard of that. At the first things that came in the crop, they were to be gathered up and offered to the Lord as a first fruits offering. And if you were bringing grain in that way, you didn't grind it up into flour. You crushed the heads of the grain, but you didn't make it into flour. And then you roasted them. And so that was just a particular way of offering the fine fruit, the first fruits offering. Oil was to be used in all the offerings, so oil was to be added to everything, even to that fine fruits. Oil was to be added, first fruits, oil was to be added to that. And for the flour offering and the grain offering, incense was to be offered, was to be placed on the offering when it was brought. So the first fruit grain, incense added to it. The flour, incense is added to it. We're not told about incense with regard to the bread offerings, the cooked bread. So it's possible that it's just implied, but it doesn't say explicitly that they're to add incense to it. And all of them, when the portion is burnt up, portions burnt up for each one, it says it makes an aroma pleasing to the Lord. So it's an offering made by fire, an aroma pleasing to the Lord.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
When is the first fruits sacrifice done?
Pardon?
When in the year?
Whenever the harvest was, I guess. I'm not quite sure when that was. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So it's like the beginning of the harvest. Yeah, the very very first part of the harvest. Now, fine flour, or could be choice flour, that's another way you could translate the phrase, came from wheat or barley, and they didn't have potatoes, because potatoes actually came from South America. They only came to Europe in about the 15 or 1600s. So it's kind of a interesting thought, isn't it? A world without potatoes. Yeah. And they didn't have rice. So these barley and wheat were their main grains, and they provided the staple for their food.
Did they have corn?
Corn? I'm not sure if they... It gets mentioned in the Old Testament, doesn't it? Corn gets a mention. Okay. Yeah.
I think in the Genesis story where there was famine in the land, there was corn in Egypt.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
It's here in verse 14, fresh ears roasted with fire.
Yeah. Yeah, whether that's corn or not. But probably the most common grain would have been barley and wheat, because it just provides such a good crop for the area that you sow, whereas corn, in a way, doesn't provide the same amount of crop for the area that you sow. That's my guess. Not entirely agricultural. The oil was pressed from... Oh, so it's fine flour because it's been through a careful winnowing and threshing and grinding. So they've really worked the grain a lot to get rid of all the kind of chaff or rough bits. It's very fine flour. So a lot more effort goes into producing fine flour than ordinary flour. Probably the ordinary person every day when they were making the bread for their family would use fairly coarse flour because it's just so much work. If you make bread at home at the moment, it's just hard work with the flour that you buy. But if you've then also got to get all the grain, it comes to a point where you just think that'll do. And so generally it was coarse flour. But for this offering, it had to be fine flour. So it really had to be very worked kind of flour. The oil was pressed from olives. Now, we're just so used to buying everything that we eat from shops. And we just got to have that completely out of our head. When Israel ate, they grew it, they processed it, they cooked it. That's what a family did. You grew your food, you processed it, and you cooked it. And you ate it. So eating a meal was a big event, you know, was the end of a long process of things.
The same in Nepal.
Right, yeah. That's right. Yeah, our prosperity just makes it very hard for us to read the Bible as clearly as, because we're just in quite a different world.
Andrew?
Yeah.
Did every family do that, or would say have done it and the rest, you know, bought their projects?
Basically, for the basics of life, the average Israelite, they'd be working their plot of land. If you go to the Philippines, everybody works their land. They don't have a lot of land, but everybody works it, and they grow their own rice. So the rice provides for the family, and then they've got, they hope to have more to sell. Subsistence living, yeah. So that would have been just the norm. So when Israel's divided up and all the tribes get their territory, that's really important. And the fact that you can't lose your land, so if you sell your land, it has to be returned to the family in the Jubilee year. As Israel grows, I guess it becomes an issue, doesn't it, as to can the land support the people? Can our plot of land support the whole family? There were cities, and people did work in cities. They weren't huge cities. Jerusalem would have been the largest city and wouldn't have been, you know, like Adelaide or anything like that. It was a much smaller city than that. Now, so you had to press the olives to get your oil. Frankincense, when it talks about incense, it literally is frankincense. And that is something that you couldn't produce. You had to buy that. It was made from the resin of a tree that didn't grow in Israel. So it was it was a costly item. And
Oman.
Okay. Rightio. So it would have been imported. And you'd only use a little bit of that because it would have been very expensive. And it wasn't an ingredient in the bread. So when it's offered, you've got to make sure that the incense is separate. It's not part of the bread, it's separate, so that all of the incense can be burned up with the bread, with the portion of the bread or the portion of the flour that you offer up. And then salt. Again, we sort of take salt for granted these days, and most people have too much of it. But at the time of the Old Testament, salt was an expensive commodity. It wasn't readily available. So when you season something with salt, you know, you wouldn't put so much in that you're going to get hard arteries. It was just to add a bit of flavour and a bit of preservative effect in what you cooked. Now, the amounts aren't specified here, how much you're meant to bring of each, but you can pick up from other passages sort of the range. But the range, it varies on the kind of situation or whatever. So some places you're meant to bring a sixth of an ephah, and sometimes up to two ephahs of flour. Talk about what they are in a moment. And the wine could be anything from an eighth of a hin to about a hin. What? So they're not measures we use. So the normal amount for a grain offering was about one-tenth of an ephah of flour. And that's about 3 kilos. It's about 15 cups, sort of in that range of 10 to 15 cups. It might be 12 cups, something like that. of flour. It's quite a reasonable amount. And the amount of oil that was to be added to that was a quarter of a hin. And that's about 1 to 1.5 litres of oil. Yeah. There's no, if you're making the bread, you don't add water to it. You just use the oil. So it's just a very oily, very dense bread is my guess. That's it. I don't know, I meant to look on a bread packet today and just see what all the ingredients are in bread these days.
Oil, and you have to put in bread improver.
Yeah.
And salt.
Righty-o.
Bread improver and salt.
Yeah, yeah. Is that if you're making your own...
Sugar and...
Right, yeah. Yeah. Is that like with a bought packet of flour or the bread mix? Be interesting to know what's in the bread mix. But this was very simple bread. Like it was flour... oil, salt. Well, it must have been edible because that's what they ate. Yeah. We've got all these things to sort of make it nice and soft and a bit flavoursome. And it would have been like a very, very rough damper in a way. And very chewy is my guess. The oil was probably the softener of it, as well as the thing that bound it all together when they cooked it. So the loaf made would be quite substantial. So if you're bringing that as a bread offering, say you've cooked it all up, it's like bringing 3 kilos of bread, or more, 3 or 4 kilos of bread. That sounds like quite a lot. We worked out that it'd be about six...
3 or 4 full loaves.
Yeah. Or six.
I think, like, our bread would be a lot lighter than this. Yeah. Quite heavy.
Right, yeah, so it'd probably be smaller.
One small dense.
Yeah. Well, it's 3 kilos of flour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what, think of a 3 kilo packet of flour.
One quite heavy loaf of bread, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, that's what would have been the normal basic food for a person or for a family every day. Probably a loaf that size would be cooked every day for the family. If you think about 3 kilos of bread. Look, we're just so used to such a varied diet, again, because we've got this prosperity that God has blessed us with. But the average family, that would have been their basic, and they would have cooked some vegetables that they grew. And then on special occasions, they may have had eggs and meat. But meat only on really special occasions, and more than likely probably chicken or birds that they caught. And occasionally, like on a really, really like a wedding or something, you'd have goat or beef, something like that. Yeah.
Would it be leavened or unleavened?
This had to be unleavened. Yeah, to bring it to the Lord, these grain offerings, you were not allowed to add yeast or honey. You weren't allowed to sweeten it. Yeast and honey were not allowed to be offered in these sacrifices, but you could bring yeast and honey or bread with yeast, grain with yeast or honey as part of the first fruit offerings. So it wasn't completely, wasn't that there was a problem as though yeast and honey were evil and never to be brought to the Lord, but for these particular offerings they were to be unleavened. And that is something symbolic about the purity of Israel's pure devotion to the Lord. It's not sort of puffed up or fake or something. I think there's something of that idea in the leavening or the unleavenedness of the offering. So bread was the most common food that an Israelite ate. It was a staple diet. Staple of the diet was a filler-upper. So... you're hungry? Go and have some of the loaf, you know. And you'd break the loaf up and you'd divide it out for the family for the day. And, you know, Dad would go out to the field and he'd have bread. You remember the story of the feeding of the 5,000, the two loaves and the five fish, or the five loaves and the two fish? Five loaves and the two fish. I mean, that would have just been like that, just a really dense little scone. That would have just been made out of a clump of this kind of stuff. And that would have been his food for the day.
That's on the punishment in prisons.
That's right, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah. But this is the norm for daily life. So if you think about it, what they're being told is to bring, for the cereal offering, bring the equivalent of your daily bread. That's what they're being told to bring. Bring your daily bread for the cereal offering.
So they still this was their daily bread? I think they just made two loaves.
They would have made more. Yeah, they would have made double.
They can only do it when they've saved up enough flour.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it really came as a particular times. Yeah. Now, this sacrifice was a costly sacrifice. It doesn't sound like much to us, does it? A bit of flour and oil or a bit of bread? But it came from the everyday setting of life, but it was costly. It took time and effort to prepare, grinding the grain and pressing the olives, and the ingredients actually were expensive. So it was fine flour. And other places in the Bible, we actually hear about fine flour being used for the food of kings. So it's kind of like food that's fit for a king is the idea of what you're bringing. To use oil instead of water to make the dough, that's using an expensive item when you could have used a cheap one. Fine flour rather than more common and cheaper coarse flours. And to add the costly frankincense was very costly to the average Israelite. Just by the way, what do you know about frankincense in the Bible? Yeah, birth of Christ. And what were they saying when they brought frankincense, those wise?
That he was a king.
That he was a king, really. They were honouring him, his lordship, his kingship, in those gifts that they brought. And so when Israel brings this gift, it's actually sort of bringing a gift to the Lord, the King. The offerer was giving something costly to the Lord, and there was sacrifice and effort involved. And this was a way of honouring and symbolising the priority of the Lord as King over us. We're his servants, so the best belongs to him. We serve him, we go out of our way to serve him. The addition of salt as seasoning to the offering was a reminder of the covenant relationship of Israel with the Lord. Salt was a common element in covenant-making ceremonies. And it symbolised the permanence of the covenant. Just flick over to Numbers 18. Verse 19. Whatever is set aside from the holy offerings the Israelites present to the Lord, I give to you and your sons and daughters as your regular share. So this is the Lord speaking to the priests. And he says, this is verse, did I tell you the verse?
19.
Yep. I give to you and your sons and your daughters as your regular share. It's an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord for both you and your offspring. So these are the two places in the Old Testament where that phrase covenant of salt is used. And here it's an everlasting covenant of salt. And maybe because the salt had a preservative kind of effect, maybe it's seen as symbolising the permanence, the upholding, the keeping of the covenant by the Lord. In offering the grain offering, the Israelites were saying that the basic fact of life for them was God's faithfulness to them. So it's seasoned with the salt of the covenant, and they're really saying, as they bring this offering, they're really saying, we can offer this to you because you're faithful to us. We don't live by bread alone, but we live by every word that comes from your mouth, which is what is said in Deuteronomy chapter 8 that Jesus quotes when he's tempted. So that they are saying that the basic fact of life for them was God's faithfulness to them. And this, of course, meant that they acknowledged in the sacrifice that they lived not by bread alone. The memorial portion. Now, from this offering that the Israelite brings, the priest was to take a memorial portion and burn it on the altar. This portion consisted of a handful of the offering. So the flour's been mixed with the oil, or the bread's been broken up, or there's the grain there, been drizzled with oil and roasted. He takes a handful of that and any all of the incense that's on the plate as well. And he burns it up on the altar as an offering made by fire and a roaming pleasing to the Lord. Now that phrase, an offering made by fire, an aroma pleasing to the Lord, is used of all the offerings apart from the guilt or reparation offering. So I don't know what to make of that, but it's just a fact that's there. It would mean something. The memorial portion was to remind the people. So why is it called a memorial portion? Like, what's the memorial? Another way you could actually translate that is a remembrance portion, or even a remembering portion. So the question is, who's remembering? Whose memory is being stirred up? And it probably is the Lord's. So as this is burnt up, it's actually to, in a way, incite the Lord to remember. It's a memorial portion, a remembering portion. So as the Lord smells it and as he's pleased, it's an aroma pleasing to him, then he remembers his people, is the point. And now that might sound odd to us. Does the Lord ever forget his people? Like, does he say, oh, you're back? No, it's not like that at all. In fact, they've already said, haven't they, as they brought this, we've said this already, that everything we have comes from you. You have remembered us. That's why we have this gift to offer you. That's part of the grain offering. But it's really to remind the people of their need for the Lord's favour. Now, this morning when you got up, did you, at any point this morning, before you went off to do whatever you need to do, think today, I really need God's favour to get through today? Anybody think that? I don't think I did today.
Subconsciously.
Yeah, subconsciously. Thinking something subconsciously. Yeah. Yeah, we did it in a very... Pardon?
Did yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think partly, again, it's a product of our prosperity, is that we probably think we'll probably get through the day anyway. We certainly will have enough food, and even if, like, we didn't eat today, we'd probably be all right till tomorrow. But this offering is to people who are subsistence level living, and so for them, yeah, Ralph.
Yeah, that was the question about the offering. Is it ad hoc or what?
Why is it offered?
And when?
Yeah, and when. It is a bit more ad hoc, so there's a variety of things. I think I've got something about that here, but I'm not sure, because it doesn't say anywhere. But it's kind of a bit like the fellowship offering, variety of things. It could be in fulfilment of a vow. Mm-hmm. It could be as part of a petition for a particular thing. It could be just a thanksgiving for God's blessings as part of the first fruits offering, so that's included in it. It could be, you know, a range of things. Probably when the offerer brings it to the priest, he tells the priest why he's brought it. So then the priest has that in mind as he's burning the portion. So it's to remember it's to celebrate the Lord's remembering of his people. It's not as though the Lord had forgotten or ever could forget his covenant people. Do you love those words in Isaiah 49? You know them. I'm sure you know them. It says, Zion, verse 14 says, Zion said, the Lord has forsaken me, the Lord has forgotten me. Then the Lord says, can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion for the child she's born? Though she may forget, I will never forget you. See, I've engraved you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are ever before me. Your sons hasten back, and those who laid you waste depart from you. Lift up your eyes and look around. All your sons gather and come to you. So this is, Israel's in the middle of a terrible judgment. They've been invaded, and they're thinking, God's forgotten us. And God's saying, no, I could never forget you. I've carved you deeper than any tat. I've written your name into the palms of my hands. It'd be like a mother forgetting the child that she's nursed.
So Israel or Judah?
At this point, it's Israel.
Really?
I believe.
Yeah, so it says in verse 9.
For the whole nation.
Yep.
Not yet divided.
Yeah, I think it's. Yeah. Now, so God doesn't forget his people. So when it's offering up a memorial portion, it's actually it's giving thanks to the fact that God does remember, but it is also calling on the Lord to remember. What does that mean if you actually ask God to remember you? Well, in the Old Testament, to remember meant to bring to mind for definite action. When the Lord remembered his people, it meant that he would intervene on their behalf. Look, there's just a whole stack of verses there. Genesis 8:1 is when the Lord remembered Noah and brings him through the floods and opens up the ark so that he can come out. And in 1929, I think that's the Lord remembering Abraham. Oh, I can't remember exactly that one. There's a few of them where the Lord remembers barren women. So 1 Samuel 1:19, the Lord remembered Hannah. And what does he do? It doesn't just mean he said, oh, Hannah, oh, I remember her. No, he actually intervenes and grants her a child. Exodus 2:24, the Lord remembered his people who were suffering in Egypt. And he intervenes for them and causes a child to be born, Moses, who's going to be their rescuer. And so on, you could read right through. Yeah.
Solomon and Gomorrah.
That's right, that's the 19 one. The Lord remembered Lot.
Yeah. Remembers Abraham.
Abraham. And saves Lot, yeah. What are you going to say? That's all right. Well, if it comes back later. So when the grain offering was made, the offerer recognised that all he had came from the gracious hand of the Lord, and he was asking the Lord to continue to be gracious and kind into the future. Mm-hmm. That's what he was doing with the grain offering.
They're basically confessing what God is.
Yeah, saying
who he is.
Yeah, yeah, and asking him for his favour into the future. We don't live by bread alone. In fact, we'll give up this bread. We just live by what comes from your mouth, the way you bless us.
I remember you're talking about God remembering, but it works the other way. Sometimes Moses
remembers.
Yeah. God, he told us this.
That's right.
So that was.
That's right. Yeah, he reminds the Lord of who he is, and in a way, that's what the grain offering is doing. That memorial portion is calling on the Lord to remember. You could have a kind of a view of God's sovereignty, where your prayers would be like, well, we believe that you're a good God and so we won't complain. But you could actually believe in God's sovereignty and say, we believe that you're a good God and so help us. even get on with it in a way.
Read the Psalms.
Yeah, the Psalms are full of prayers like that.
Is it not so much telling God what to do, but just communicating with him and
certainly in the Psalms there's elements of that, like the kind of the tense or the form of the verb is a command verb.
One says wake up.
That's right. So I mean, we shouldn't be too squeamish in our prayer life with God. If we get squeamish and feel we can't speak to him as a friend would speak with a friend, which at times is with strength. If we feel like we've got to be always putting it in a nice way so he's not offended, then what have we understood about grace in a way, I think? Grace enables us to talk to God very directly.
Psalm 13.
Right.
It starts off like that.
Yeah.
It finishes up, I trust in you.
Yeah, that's right.
First bit. They're all doing just what you say.
Yeah.
Telling God what,
what he's doing and what he's not done. And yeah. And I mean, to be honest, all of us think that. And if we ever get the guilt about it, the best thing to do is actually to tell. I mean, it's one thing to think it. It's much, much better to actually say it to God. Once you actually express what's in your heart, you're halfway to to finding out about who he actually is in a fresher, wonderful way. Now, in a time of in a place and time of prosperity, we may forget that all we have comes from his hand and how much we depend on his favour and grace. But, you know, life can change course in the blink of an eye. I reckon a lot of the events that have happened this year have shocked us, and part of the shock is that we've suddenly thought that all that we thought was secure can be swept away in seconds. You know, the siren sound and everything's gone. If nothing else, many of the disastrous events of this year have told us this. All things are in the hands of the Lord. We need to cast all our cares on him, and we need to seek him for our future. All in all, the grain offering was a kind of way of praying, Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come. There was a kingship theme through this. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread.
That's quite beautiful, isn't it,
right? Yeah. Provision for the ministers of God. The rest of the offering belonged to Aaron and his sons, that is, to the priests. It was a most holy part of the offerings made to the Lord and was to be eaten in a holy place. So this, when it's called a most holy part of the offerings, it means that it couldn't ever then be taken out of the tabernacle or the temple. It was a sanctified thing. So it could never be made common or, just used for any other purpose. It was there for the priests, and they had to eat it in a holy place. So that meant the courtyard of the tabernacle, which means all the area around the altar of burnt sacrifice. So just imagine that you have to go and eat bread where animals are being killed, where blood's being splashed, where you've got the smell of burning flesh and burning flour, burning incense, all these things going up on the altar. And in that courtyard is where the priest would come in and they'd eat their portion of bread. Over time they actually built little rooms for storing things there so that they didn't have to eat it all at once.
Yeah. I think you switched terminology with holy and most holy.
Yeah,
most holy is
inside, but they were allowed to eat it in a holy place. So it's a most holy offering, but they had to eat it in the holy place. Like, you couldn't eat it in the most holy place. Yeah, it means you have to go where the altar incense was and the most holy place. Right. Yeah.
That time.
Yeah, but you've got the courtyard where the altar is, and then you've got the next bit behind where you've got the lampstand and the showbread and the altar of incense.
Yes.
You didn't eat it in there. That was the most holy place. Yeah, but this is the holy place around the courtyard of the tabernacle, and you had to eat it.
So the people, for those animal sacrifices, they actually came in there, didn't they?
Yeah. So they were sanctifying themselves when they did that. Yeah. And that's why you had to be clean to come in there. Yeah. So there were sort of transition points. There were, you had to be clean to come into a holy place, and a most holy thing could be eaten in a holy place. So there was like this courtyard with the altar in was like a transition point between the presence of God in his you know, the bare presence of God in his holiness, and the world where God was not bare present like that, but sort of more mediated presence.
I know it's funny saying where God can move, but the way they set it up, he couldn't move out of that, could he? Is it not holy? Correct?
Well, God was free to do anything, and he does. That's what happens in Ezekiel. He ups and outs of the out of the tabernacle and heads off with that vision he has. At the start of Ezekiel is God leaving the tabernacle, God leaving the temple and going into exile. So God is God, but it's the access to the presence of God is only there in the tabernacle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So God is everywhere. That's so clear in the Old Testament as well as the New. But access to him, like the presence of God or the bare presence where you can actually meet God, that's not open to everybody.
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
In that sense, he's everywhere but gone from the temple. Would they have changed?
I don't know if they would have noticed it or not. But the problem would have been them rather than the situation. Yeah. I mean, people can lose... I think for us as sinners, that's kind of thing about us as sinners, we're so used to not having access to the presence of God that we don't really notice it. We just kind of think life goes on and we have a few spiritual experiences and think, wow. But think about what it must have been to walk with God every evening in the cool of the day, as Adam and Eve did. That must have been... That's something beyond what we would kind of know, really, isn't it?
Sorry.
Yeah.
On the same foot. God appeared to Jacob, he appeared to Abraham. Start with Abraham. So he's appearing to the men.
Yeah.
But this is more of a...
That's right.
Regulated.
Yeah. And it's a way of approaching God to seek his favour. When God appears to somebody like that, what's the next thing that they do? They bow down, and then the next thing they do is they generally build an altar.
Yeah.
Because to seek his favour requires a certain approach. Yeah.
For the whole
country. Yeah. So,
But they also offer hospitality, as in Abraham and the three angels.
That's right, yeah. And that's such a... In Genesis 18, that's such an...
The offering straight away.
Yeah.
The same sort of thing.
That's right, yeah. Now, whoever touched this offering was made holy and so could not perform common duties until the time of consecration was passed. The holy place was the courtyard. And when a priest, just by the way, when a priest offered his own grain offering, so a priest could actually offer a grain offering, but when he did that, and particularly the son of the high priest had to do that at the investiture of the new high priest, that offering was to be burned in its entirety. None of it was to be eaten by the priest. So there was a sense, if you brought a grain offering, saying we receive everything as daily bread from the mouth of God, then you couldn't eat that offering. That wasn't for you. You were actually saying, I depend on God for my daily bread. So if you were then to claim a bit back for it, from it, you'd sort of be saying you don't really depend on God, you'll sort of manage it yourself, really. So in this way, the grain offerings bear some similarity to the fellowship offerings. In the fellowship offerings, a part of the offered animal was burned on the altar and a part of the animal was given to the priest for food. Like the fellowship offerings, the grain offerings could be given at times of thanksgiving, petition or vow fulfilment, and specifically were to be given as a first fruits offering and could be given just as a free will offering. The grain offering with the fellowship offering was an important part of the continuity of Israel's worship. If the grain offerings never happened, Israel's worship actually would have come to a complete halt. The tabernacle or the temple would have had to shut its doors. Why?
The priest would starve.
That's right, the priest would starve. Well, the priests and the Levites had certain cities in Israel that were assigned to them, and there was even some land around the cities that was assigned to the priests, but they didn't have farming land. They had enough land to grow vegetables on, probably keep some flocks and herds, but not nearly enough to feed a whole tribe of priests and Levites. That never would have been possible.
It was a 3-year tithe.
That's right, the tithe, we saw that last time with the fellowship offering, that the third year of the tithing was always set aside for the poor and the Levites and the widows. And every year's tithe, when the person offered a fellowship offering, they were to invite the Levites and the priests that they knew to come and to share in that meal. So, but that's quite a thing. If the grain offering didn't happen, the temple closed down. I heard somebody on a talk about this say that he thinks that in Nehemiah that may have been one of the things that happened. But I couldn't find it. I went through and through Nehemiah. I couldn't find anything like that.
If it's ad hoc, then it's possible.
It's risky, isn't it? Yeah.
God,
yeah.
God's risk
Yeah, the first fruits wasn't ad hoc. That happened every year regardless. But most of it was ad hoc. It wasn't for any particular thing other than something that you chose in a way to do.
The priests could learn to depend on the Lord too.
That's right, the priests had to depend on the Lord.
Andrew, this was only for the priests. I can't remember what the other ones we've done. The stuff for the Levites. But is this the only one that...
That's right, yeah. The meat from the fellowship offerings went to the priests, but the tithes and the fellowship offering feast included the Levites. They get specific mentions in those things. By these offerings, the priests had a source of food that they could not have like other Israelites. They were not farmers and didn't have large territory in Israel apart from some of the land surrounding certain cities. They would have, as we said, grown vegetables and pastured some animals. By the gifts brought in the grain and fellowship offerings, the priests were enabled to conduct their important ministry for the Lord and for Israel. In the book of Malachi, the failure of Israel to bring the tithe was described as robbery toward God. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, commanded the Lord. So do you see, it's not food for God, the tithe. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Now that could mean in Israel for the poor, but it could mean very easily, specifically, food for the priests.
That's what I'm saying.
That's right, yeah. That's right. Yeah, and I need to be worshipped because in that way you're blessed as my people. If the priests don't perform their duty, what happens? Israel remains in her sins.
Taken up in the New Testament, a quote from Numbers, I think.
Yeah.
Thou shalt not muzzle the ox.
That's right, yeah, we're going to come to those verses there.
The labourer is worthy of his hire.
Yeah. Yeah, of his hire. It seems as though the people believed in Malachi that it would be imprudent to do the tithing at that time. Things were tough. So they thought it would be more prudent to keep the food for themselves until such time as they could really afford to do the tithe. They'd become jaded and believed that serving the Lord was futile. So they were saying, look, if we do this, it's going to be a risk. And we don't really believe that God will look after us. The whole thing with the grain offering was it was saying, we believe that you look after us. And we're asking you to look after us. They're saying, well, no, we'll just take things into our own hands by not tithing, by not giving the offerings that they were to give.
Do you know what state Israel was in?
Malachi, not exactly sure. Yeah, it's pretty late. So it's after the exile and they've returned. So things were tough when they got back from the exile. Mm-hmm. Took a long time for the economy to recover. But the Lord's dare to them is that they should test him. Go and test me. Bring in your tithes and see what I do. His promise is that faithfulness in seeking him in this way would see him open the floodgates of blessing on them. In the New Testament, the leaders of churches were called to exemplary leadership, and they were not to be greedy for money or gain from their position. The congregations that they led were called to be generous in providing for them so that they could go about this task without being hindered by the need to provide for them and their families. So it's kind of a double thing, isn't it? Those in ministry are called to not be greedy for money, but those who they serve are called to support them so that they can go about their task without having to worry about how they're going to eat.
Yeah, Paul says, "Am I right? But if they pull back,
yeah,
I won't take it."
Yep. The elders, it says in 1 Timothy 5, who direct the affairs of the church well, are worthy of double honour. That word double honour probably means double pay. It wasn't that they were employed. It wasn't like a wage. But actually saying, give them generously so they don't have any cause to worry about how they might live.
Are we therefore in this century living against the wrong way with the paying stipends and stuff?
That's a good question. Yeah. So they're worthy of double honour, especially those whose work is preaching and teaching. The Old Testament law about how cattle are to be treated humanely and generously, if you watched Four Corners, the Old Testament says a lot about that. God cares for both man and beast. But anyway, cattle are to be treated humanely and generously. So imagine a cow with a big bar on its shoulders and it's the bar is tethered over there, and this cow just walks around in a circle all day dragging this thing, and what he's dragging is he's turning a grindstone, which is grinding grain. Grain that falls out onto the floor, Israel was not allowed to pick it up and put it back under the grindstone. They had to leave that for the cows to eat.
I've got a lovely photo of that actually happening in India.
Right.
No muscles on the ox.
Right, yeah.
And then round and round they go.
Yeah. So do not muzzle the ox while it's treading out the grain. Now that's from Deuteronomy, but it's quoted in the New Testament, and pastors are compared to cows. I think it's outrageous. Yeah. A real cow of a pastor. And also the worker deserves his wages. Right through the Old Testament it's clear, isn't it, that if you owe somebody a wage, you pay it as soon as you can. But that quote is actually from the teaching of Jesus himself in Luke 10, where he sent out the 72 in his name and on his mission. He says, go, if a man of peace receives you, stay at his house and eat and drink whatever he provides for you. He says, for a worker is worthy of his hire. So that's a really good thing to just have in mind, is that congregations, which isn't just organisations, actually people, congregations of God's people should have in mind that they make sure that if they want their pastors to serve them well in the ministry of God's word and sacraments, in prayer and in pastoral care, they should make sure that it's possible for them to do that without being caught between two concerns. How do I look after my family as well as do this ministry?
What about their world? Well, again, I think it's relative, isn't it?
Yeah. 10 very poor families should, on the principle of the tithe, be able to look after one very poor pastor. We do have an odd situation in our time. Pastors now actually have rights and they have packages, and most pastors, I think, are actually paid reasonably well, and in many situations may actually be paid better than quite a few members of their congregation. And that seems to me to get to a really difficult spot. It actually becomes more and more impossible for a congregation to support pastors in that situation, where the average of the congregation, the average income of the congregation is lower than the income of the pastor.
That's because they're tithing bills, isn't it? Well, they're getting the stuff money from the bill suites.
Well, no, in our situation, denominations and churches actually set an amount that congregations have to pay.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that common, like, for a pastor to be that little
thing? I think it's getting more so in Australia. I think most pastors are... I think there's been quite a change in 20 years or so. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be 100% sure, but... I think mainline churches too have pretty good packages. Yeah.
In Nepal, there's not a single expatriate minister. Mm. They're all indigenous.
Yeah.
And they're all supported by their congregation.
Yeah.
Mm. No outside money going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or if there is, it's under the cut.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably a really good principle to have in mind, is that it's probably unwise for a Western person to start supporting the ministry in a non-Western church, because undoubtedly what you provide will be vastly more than local people can provide, and will firstly elevate the living standard of the pastor and raise a level of expectation that's just... would be impossible for that local situation to ever sustain. Yeah. Roland Allen is a missiologist from the turn of the 1900s, and he argued that pastors should not be paid stipends or wages, that they should receive gifts, that there shouldn't be an agreed payment, like a kind of an employment contract. I'm quite taken by his thoughts, but I don't know that the New Testament would make a law of it. No. But I think there's a lot to think about. But whatever, the basic things is that the pastors, the elders, are never to be greedy for money. They should not be serving in their role because it's a good lurk. And they should not be using their role to further their own financial situation. Sadly, that happens. In Australia, it happens. There are some pastors, some high-profile stuff that you hear where clearly some pastors are manipulating their situation for their financial benefit. But on the other hand, having said that, that a pastor is never to be greedy for money. If they weren't paid, they would, like Paul does, tent make so that they can serve, but it'll be less than they can do if they're fully supported. Yep. The same way, a congregation should never take their pastor for granted and should do everything they can to enable them to live and provide for their family and go about the ministry as easily as possible for them. So it's kind of, it's love both ways. That's the best way to handle it, is love both ways. So in 1 Corinthians 9, Paul sets out what should be done for those who are engaged in the ministry of the gospel, arguing that those who sow spiritual seed among God's people deserve a material harvest from these people. He says, don't you know those who work in the temple get their food from the temple? So he's picking up this whole thing that we're looking at. And those who serve at the altar, sharing what's offered on the altar. In the same way, the Lord's commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. And I think when he says the Lord's commanded that, he actually is picking up that statement from Luke 10, where the Lord says the worker is worthy of his hire. Yet he also goes on to show how, in order that the gospel in no way be hindered, he let go of these rights and put up with anything, he says. This is the dynamic of the gospel itself. For us today in our churches, congregations who desire that they have elders who are able to devote themselves to the ministry of the word and sacraments, prayer and pastoral care, need to do all they can to ensure that these men are able to do so without also having to find the means to live. It's really important.
I'm thinking the churches I know, pastor gets stipend, but the other elders.
Yeah, that's right. So it does depend, like, are those people... The question is whether, is the church saying we need all these people to be full-time? Like, the whole point of providing the stipend isn't like a reward. It's actually so that the person can work full-time in the ministry that God's given them to. Yeah, yeah. So it really is a matter, like, if somebody saying, I don't need a full-time stipend, I won't be able to do this full-time, I give a day a week, then the church thinks, okay, do a proportional thing, or maybe the person will just do it voluntarily, or whatever, it's sort of, it's not really setting rules, but it is actually sort of talking about responsibilities. Thoughtfulness about providing for these ministers is needed. I don't know how you think about your finances. Who here has a budget? Like, how do you budget how you spend your money? Anybody? Sort of? Yeah.
Mentally.
Done?
You do.
I do. I reckon it's, for me, it was a turning point for me to actually think about budgeting, to realise if I think about how I'm spending my money, I can be more purposeful in what I do with it. And that's what budgeting is. It's actually being purposeful about how you use your money. And I'll read through my notes here and come back to that. Israel, in its tithing and in the first fruit offerings, had to consider the whole of God's blessing on them and bring an appropriate amount to the Lord. So as the income came in, income equals grain, wine, oil, they actually had to set aside a tenth of it. They couldn't get to the end of the year and try and sort of conjure it up from something. As it came in, they had to think about it and set aside and budget for what they were going to do when they brought their once a year tithe to the Lord.
Animals involved there?
Animals, yeah. Yeah, the firstborn. Yeah, a tithe of the firstborn. Or no, all of the firstborn males or something. Whatever. A little bit vague there. Now, today it takes thoughtfulness about our income and preparation to ensure that the amount we give to support the ministers in our congregations is appropriate. Just pulling out your wallet at the time of the offering to see what you've got. Well, very often there's nothing in there, is there? Because other things have sort of taken priority during the week. Well, in the end, it kind of the dishonouring of God's gracious gift of the preaching and teaching of his word and the pastoral care of the congregation by the gifted ministers that he provides. Could you imagine, just by the way, if it comes to your payday and the guy pulls out and says, oh, sorry, not this week. Like, I think there'd be a general outcry of outrage about that, and yet I reckon that's kind of what we do to our ministers.
It's really sin by omission.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's probably one of those unintentional sins, since we haven't thought about it. Yeah, haven't planned it. So I read today that 25% of Jesus' teaching in the Gospels is about money. Isn't that interesting? When was the last time you heard a sermon about money and how you use money? Not in a while.
Does this count?
No. Yeah. And so I just reckon that it's really worthwhile giving thought to how do you organise yourself financially so that you can serve and love God with everything you have and are. And budgeting, I think, is just a really natural part of that. It's actually thinking about, I've got so much income. I don't want to set myself up as, because I don't think I'm actually that good at this. I take care with it. But I think a principle for us has been, we think about our income, and then the first part that's apportioned is the stuff we're going to give away. If you don't make it the first part that you apportion, it always gets smaller. If you make it the first part that you apportion, it's always the right amount. It's always an appropriate amount if you make it the first thing that you apportion.
Is tithing an interesting command?
It's not commanded, no. Yeah.
Adopted it from the Old Testament.
That's right, yeah. There's, right through the New Testament, there's definitely things about giving and gifts and supporting, like all that stuff we've just read about, supporting elders and pastors and all that's, you know, the work is worthy of his hire, all that's all through there. But an absolute amount, just by the way, the tithe was just one part of what Israel offered. And remember, the tithe for them was stuff that they ate themselves in their own party, by and large, although some of it went to the priests. But it was a party they invited others into as well. So it was part of their social welfare, part of their celebration, all that kind of stuff.
The first tithe was Abraham, right?
Yeah,
how did he
give a tithe? Yeah, I don't know. Ask him when you see him in heaven, all right?
He got the principle.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, Abel and Cain are offering up gifts from their
first fruit.
Their first fruits, right at the very beginning there. And how did they know that? I think there must be something about the nature of God, that God himself is a giving and sacrificial God, that somehow is written deep into us that giving and sacrifice is really important. So I'd encourage you to think about that. As for Israel, there'll be times when you think, I don't know if I can afford it. But then you hear the word of the Lord that says, dare you, test me, see what I'll do for you. I think it could involve a range of things, really. Yeah. I think some of those other things might be closer to like burnt offering kind of things, which we're going to get onto next term. But, so I don't know the practicalities of it, whether that's something you feel like it, something that you can deal with. Like, do you get trained in that kind of stuff at school? The practicalities of managing a budget? No. You do? Yeah. Listen really hard to those lessons when they come your way. Like, they're just such a great... They're actually... They just seem so mundane. But, you know, grinding flour and pressing olives was pretty mundane. Hard work. You just did it. And then it enabled you to worship God and serve his people. And
don't make a work theology out of it like the Pharisees did.
That's right. The other thing with it is don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing, which doesn't mean be completely confused. It means just do it as privately, as secretly as possible so that you're not kind of trying to get any...
If you look at the tithing stuff and then all the other offerings, it's really much more than 10%.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And we've got a funny thing that says, like, okay, we don't have to tithe. So I would have thought when the Spirit of God comes and dwells in his people and the fullness of grace is opened up to us in Jesus, rather than being the kind of people who want to do less, we kind of almost want to do more. I'd kind of think that that would be the what grace would be. But it seems to me like, oh, we don't have to tithe anymore. You know, like, if you look at most churches in Australia and looked at the average giving per family per week, it's miserable. Like, if the family was actually saying this is a tenth of our income, most people and most Christians in Australia would be poor, like below the poverty line. They really would.
There's the overseas gifts and things.
Yeah, that's right. All that other stuff's happening. Yeah.
What do you think, Andrew, in terms of proportions of giving, in terms of your church that you attend and then other ministries?
Yeah, I reckon pray to the Lord about that. You know, and just have the general principle of you're not giving a certain amount to the Lord. Everything you do with your money is service of God. So when you buy food for your family, you're serving the Lord. When you pay the electricity bill, you're serving the Lord. Reluctantly, albeit. And when you bring your offering to church, you're serving the Lord. And so all of it's service of the Lord. And then it's really, I don't think I'd want to make a general rule. For me, like, I think I'd want at least half of what I give to go to the church. Yeah. Given that we're in a fairly large and pretty wealthy church.
Yeah, well, you just said before, churches, some ministers have packages, or
yeah,
I know, all the money that you put in the collection
basically goes to them. No, that's right. And so, you know, when your money goes to pay the electricity bill at church, that's actually serving God too. You know, I think we'd all love to support the missionary in Tanzania, but supporting your church administrator, if the church has got somebody set apart to ensure that things work well, that's as much serving the Lord as anything. So, yeah, I just reckon pray about it and see what God has for you to do on those things. But make sure that what you've done is you've said, okay, I want to set apart this amount to the Lord out of what I receive, and do that as your first thing, and see how much he blesses you. And just to bear testimony to my good wife, I remember we were on a I was on a half stipend as a youth worker in a church, and then I got ordained and came onto a full stipend, and Liz said, excellent, now we can give more away. That's a really good way to think. That's a really good way to think. And so when you see what you can give, I just reckon one of the biggest adventures in life is working how much more you can give away. Yeah. Like, it's just the, you know, you don't want to be foolish. You've got to fulfil all your responsibilities. But just thinking, okay, we could even add this into what we do regularly is a really, really beautiful way to think. So I think too, it probably means we need to speak with each other in our churches at church meetings pretty thoroughly and honestly, and we need to say, is that important or not important? Could, you know, we actually need to think about the way we budget in churches. I think sometimes churches just go wacko, let's spend the money and it'll come in. I don't think that's a good way of thinking either, you know, that churches have responsibilities too, and they shouldn't be so extravagant that it's thoughtless of other people. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Well, anyway. Church types anyway, doesn't
it? Well, not all churches do. No. I know really large evangelical churches in Adelaide that give nothing outside of their own situation. They encourage their members to give to other things, but they, of their own income, they give nothing away. I know it's kind of... doesn't sound right, but yeah. It sounds to me a bit like the priest giving a grain offering and then eating it all himself. But anyway. Anyway. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to make a rule of that, but, you know, not all churches do that. But I think it's a good principle for a church to do, just to, as a kind of a testimony.
Church be keeping what his left hand does from his right hand? As in, would the church be telling people, we're giving to these people and these people and this missionary?
They probably should, just for accountability reasons, I think. Yeah, just so that, I think that when a church is receiving money, they need to account for that honestly and fairly and transparently. So really important in that way. Other questions or thoughts? Like, I just think it's, yeah, Ev.
How this applies to what you said last week, in that if you are seriously in debt, that it's good to pay that off.
Yeah.
Because there's no commandment that says to tithe, but
that's
there's
right.
a commandment that says not to owe man.
Yeah.
How does that work in budgeting if
you're
in debt, but... Just
like
a practical question.
Yeah. We've got a kind of an economy that works on debt.
Yeah.
And so I think it would mean... So I think if you've got a certain amount of income, you say, okay, we're going to give this away. We also have these responsibilities. And by budgeting, you actually make sure it all works out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you've actually got enough to cover all the things that you committed to. So if you've made an agreement with somebody that you're going to pay a certain amount per month or whatever to buy your house or whatever, I mean, you have to do that in Australia if you're going to own a house. It's kind of just seems to be the... I can't see any other way that somebody could own property in Australia now, given the prices of land and housing. So you make an agreement with the bank, and then you fulfil, you know, you meet your obligations, and if possible, like, it's just sensible to try and pay that off quicker. Anyway, financially it's sensible, but I think spiritually it's sensible too to try and free yourself from debt. But you do think, I've got to give some expression to the Lord that I'm trusting Him by giving away a proportion of what He's given me, so that I can say, I really do believe that I live by everything that comes from You. I don't have to hang on to all that comes my way, because I believe that You'll care for me. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. So budgeting, I just think, just think through, what do I have to pay? What do I get in? And what do I have to pay? And with what's left over, and don't put the tithing in the and with what's left over, but with what's left over, what else could I do with that? Yeah.
I call it the Lord's money.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that also is a blessing to give. I mean, we all love giving.
Yeah.
Don't we?
Yeah.
The blessing that comes from.
Yeah.
Not that we give together. Yeah.
In Charles Dickens, in I think it's David Copperfield, or Great Expectations, The Micawbers. Do you know which novel that is?
Oh, David
Copperfield. There's this character called Mr. Micawber, and he and his family are they're comic characters anyway, but they're poor. He's got a motto. He's learned a motto through his bitter experiences, which is income £9, expenditure £8, 12 pence or whatever it is. Result, happiness. Income £9, expenditure £9, 1 pence. Result, misery. He's worked out how to budget. Yeah, he does end up in the pauper's prison, but that's how he's learned his lesson. It's kind of one way, like stuff that you can give to. There's an endless number of requests. Don't feel bad about saying no to many of them. A lot of the requests, even in Christian circles, do kind of work on a kind of guilt thing. They spell out all the need and all the suffering, and you feel like such a heel when you shred the letter or whatever it is you do with it. Those letters that end up in my compost bin, that's why I shred them. But so I thank those who've sent them to me as I serve the Lord in this way. So you don't actually have to answer every request that's come to you, but do pray about it and just see how you can serve God with the things that He's given you. So.
To actually receive, because
that's
the
sort
of makes people feel like they should be not be dependent.
Yeah. Mm. Mind you, I reckon the last 30 years, most of my lifetime, Australia has developed much more of a handout mentality, even for middle class, what we call middle class welfare. I mean, if somebody was to take away the family tax payments now, can you imagine that would be the end of them politically? We've become dependent upon. It's a bit bizarre thing. We pay more tax in order to get a handout back. You know, it's a little bit kind of. That's been a real shift in my lifetime. I think you would have seen that, I guess, particularly that the amount of government giving is, and often to situations where it might be better not to take the money and have people. Responsible for how they manage their own affairs might be a better thing in society. I'm not sure.
But we're a really rich country.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah, we are.
Who's getting the minerals?
Yeah.
It's also taken away the community voluntary giving to those people.
Yeah, that's right. People expect the government to look after people. Yeah, the levels of philanthropy, even amongst non-Christians in the US, is much, much, much higher than in Australia. You know, philanthropy giving to support, you know, giving to needs and causes and whatever. Australians, even wealthy Australians, in comparison to Americans, give much, much less.
Did you say non-Christians?
Yeah, non-Christians or Christians, either way, yeah.
Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Matt Damon.
Yeah.
They're all doing things
overseas.
Yeah. I mean, they're
wealthy as
whatever.
Yeah. So we've got a mentality in Australia that you don't give, you sort of get. It's kind of, and that's I think that it's a shift, because I think, yeah.
Do you think that's partly as well because we're all less community now and more
individualistic? Yeah. Possibly, yeah.
So we don't have that interaction.
Yeah. Mind you, you'd also have to say at certain times that really, like when the tsunami happened in Indonesia and with the floods, you know, the level of support for those one-off events was much, you know, was quite significant. Yeah.
So I remember you preaching at summer school and said, let's not get our, self-righteousness.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Anyway.
Another way to look at it is you can actually enjoy paying tax.
Right? That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, in a way, the tax system. Yeah. The tax system is an outgrowth of our Christian heritage. Yeah. Absolutely. The tax system is a way of actually providing for others in need. That's what it's changing now. You see, with middle class welfare and tax rebates for all kinds of things that wealthy people can afford, like solar panels and so on. All of that stuff is about the tax then going back to help the wealthy. But the tax system really grew out of a Christian concern that those with lots of wealth could actually support those with less wealth.
That was in England.
Yeah. Yeah. Or in Europe, really, in general. I mean, there's elements of the tax system that existed before that, which was about supporting the military side of government and so on. But in general, that's what the tax is for. So I think when you get your tax taken out, you say, beauty, that's another way I'm serving God.
Can't you get, I heard something about giving your tithe and you can, that can help your tax return or something.
Yeah, there's all kinds of ways. There's all kinds of... yeah. Well, I think... Yeah. Yeah. That's right. You know, some people, when I was in a church, I was a treasurer for a while, and one of the most depressing things you could ever do is become a church treasurer. I'm sorry to say, you just see a side of people, you know, people say, well, you're talking about tithing, do I have to do that before tax or after tax? And I thought, oh, who gives a stuff? Really? Like, what's the level of generosity where, you know, the 10% of the 10% or whatever it is going to matter so much, right? But we need good Christian treasurers in churches, so, you know, I had no training and I spilt port all over the church books. but I got through the year. And I balanced the books at the end, so I was very, very. It's a really good experience too. You do learn a lot doing that kind of thing. So you learn a lot about bookkeeping and human nature and all kinds of things. I reckon we've rambled enough. Let's pray together. Dear Father God, you have blessed us with so much. And we thank you for the many great gifts that you have given to our culture and our community and to us. Father, please teach us every day to know that we don't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from your mouth. And so set our hearts not on the accumulation of wealth, but on the glad serving of you. We pray this in the name of our Lord Jesus. Amen.